Welcome to the May edition of the Medical Care Blog podcast. I'm Jess Williams, an associate professor at the Pennsylvania State University and a co-editor of the medicalcareblog.com. I'm going to start with a quick apology. Last month, we had some technical difficulties sending out email notifications for new blog entries. Sorry we had the issue, and we hope that it's fixed now. We had some excellent entries last month. A two-part series on whole person health by Elena Rosenbaum, Marva Richards, and Andrea Gordon describes how whole person health could improve health equity. Whole person health emphasizes caring for the entire person and also considers how other factors, such as the community and society, can influence their health, a position very consistent with many entries we've published over the years. The relationship approach of whole person health focuses on what matters to the patient rather than what is the matter with the patient. Check out their two-part series for some great reading. In another post focusing on patients and their families, Ellen Schultz, Catherine Ast, and Rebecca Kirsch continue their discussion of outpatient palliative care. Building on their previous entry, they share some lessons learned from their co-development of measures within their technical expert clinical user patient panel. Their takeaways would be useful for many different kinds of groups with different people and stakeholders working together. I encourage you to read their piece and use the lessons in the groups that you are a part of. I know I will be. The last blog of the month by Renit Missouri and Catherine Hampton makes the argument that broadband is a human right. Their arguments bring up many issues made even more salient by the pandemic, such as the increasing digitization of life and the digital divide. Check out their piece and see what you can do to help improve broadband access. Next, I'm going to have a conversation with Dr. Tammy Gurley, who is an associate professor at the University of Kansas Medical Center. Dr. Gurley has a PhD in economics and is also the director of the Health Policy and Management PhD program at KUMC. Thank you for being here today, Tammy.
Thank you for having me.
So I've heard that you've been doing a lot of prediction modeling since the pandemic started. Can you tell me a little bit about how you got involved in these local and state efforts to model COVID outcomes?
Yes, absolutely. And I wish I had a formula to tell people how to get involved in these kind of policy things, but it turns out just being in the right place at the right time. Decisions needed to be made, and the dean of the medical school at KU started pulling people together with different skill sets. And so I was kind of the data person who came onto the team. And at the time, the only question that people were really interested in is, what is the surge going to be? How many beds do we need in July of 2020?
That makes sense. So what kinds of data sources have you been using in these efforts?
So I am very biased toward using publicly available data sources. When you have the restricted data sources, sometimes your access can ebb and flow. And these were forecasts that need to be generated on a daily basis sometimes. And so it had to be data that I could grab. And so I've largely been grabbing data from GitHub, the New York Times, COVID data.
That makes sense. So how are your modeling efforts and kind of those of other economists, how do they differ from some of the more epidemiology-driven models?
Yeah, and so I rationalize this in my mind, whether this makes sense or not, as I call the epi models, right? They're very theoretically and mathematically based. They're actually quite beautiful, and they work really well on the theoretical side. In economics, you know, we have a lot of models also, and I think of the ones that I had in macroeconomics. They're very beautiful, sophisticated models. I say that what I'm doing is actually forecasting, because the problem with the models is that they are beautiful and they are internally consistent, but sometimes they don't match the data very well. And that is what was happening in the early days of COVID. Most of these models were predicting exponential growth, which leads to very, very fast increase in cases. Now, the interesting thing is we've seen that number of hospitalizations and cases, but it's been over 2 years. And so at the time, one of the models that was being run in the health system was saying we would need 5,000 beds in July of 2020. It's a lot of beds. Looking at the data from Kansas, from around the world, following the curves, trying to look at states that had COVID before us, and so using a very data-driven approach, trying to predict where we might be, I was getting something like 50 beds. And so we were orders of magnitude different in our predictions.
That must have been challenging meetings.
Those were quite fun meetings. You know, and in the early days, it can still be argued that, okay, well, maybe the data patterns are right, but maybe it just hasn't taken off yet. Maybe mm-hmm. it will be exponential, but it just hasn't taken off yet. And so, yes, there was a lot of back and forth.
I can imagine. So the whole time, were you mostly still focused on sort of forecasting beds, or did sort of the outcomes change over time?
Yeah, we were definitely looking at different things over time. I think early on, it was that hospital capacity we wanted to know. Of course, you don't really know. I mean, it's a new disease. You really don't know the relationship between case spread and mm-hmm. hospitalizations. Mm-hmm. They were changing testing policies all the time. Are we testing asymptomatic right. people? Are we not? Are we population testing a place like Lansing Prison? If we do that, we're going to pick up a bunch of cases. Mm-hmm. But that's going to be different than a community testing where you're picking right. up cases. So I think, you know, over time we started focusing on hospitalizations as more of a steady marker, and then decided maybe that wasn't perfect because there's capacity constraints. And so we would have long-term care facilities that couldn't transfer people out because the hospitals were full. Mm-hmm. And so just the hospitalizations weren't giving us a whole picture of what COVID was looking like because of they couldn't take the transfers. Lately, this is fun, we've been mostly focusing on wastewater data.
I mean, that makes sense. It's pretty hard to fake that.
Right. It's, you know, you just collect the samples and it is what it is. But challenges with that too, because Delta and Omicron have different, we think, shedding rates, right?
Oh,
and
interesting.
So you're going to pick up more disease with certain variants just because of how much gets shed.
Interesting. So was Omicron then, did it have a higher shed? Higher shedding than Delta?
We think it had a higher shed. And then, I mean, the nice thing is we have seen lower mortality per case in Omicron than we had in Delta. And I think it is some combination of vaccinations, knowing how to treat things better. Mm-hmm. And then also we think Omicron was less severe on average. And so exactly which piece played what role in that, I'm not sure.
That's a little hard to determine.
Yes.
So what's been the most surprising thing that you found during this whole process?
I think I feel really lucky to have kind of been at the table where people were literally struggling with very basic decisions. Like, do we close the soda fountains down? Mm-hmm. Are they a risk? Do we, you know, and just then those decisions had to be made on the day when you don't have evidence. And so you're just pulling. I remember a friend who was at the Kauffman Foundation used to say the lack of published data doesn't mean there's a lack of evidence. And so what we were doing was pulling data from every data point we can get. Did a school test their kids? Okay, what were their results? Mm-hmm. What were the results out of Lansing Prison? What were the results out of the long-term care facilities? And just pulling all those pieces of information together. So, you know, I think the most surprising thing was we're doing that. We're trying to make decisions in real time, but there's still different frames. And I think you see this play out in COVID all the time, right? I'm an economist and how I approach decision making and people's behavior is very different than someone from a public health background. And so
definitely,
my hope out of this is that we continue to bring more and more perspectives to the table.
That's a great suggestion. So what types of analyses seem to be the most helpful to sort of folks making these kind of organizational and sort of regional policies? What was really convincing to them?
I think, you know, when there was a lot of consistent evidence pointing in the same direction, and that when it was tough when things wouldn't point in the same direction. So, for instance, you would think you could use cases to model deaths, which is something we never did because sometimes they moved in opposite directions, right? And it really depends on how much you're testing and all of that. So I think it was the consistency of evidence. When we see the wastewater numbers going up, when we see positivity rates going up, those aren't perfect. They have a lot of moving parts, but there was never one piece of data, I think, that was convincing. It was more
using the whole picture.
Yes. And what was super helpful, and I think maybe not everybody had access to, and we didn't carefully collect this data, but it was reported to us on a regular basis, was out of the health system, and they were testing their employees on a regular basis.
Okay.
And so employee testing was a good marker for how much spread there was in the community because they go back home, right? And and so some of these pieces of data, I think, weren't like easily publicly available, but were very important for decision making.
That makes sense. So I have one last question. Do you have any suggestions for folks who are maybe more junior in their careers and how they might learn forecasting and how to like basically get ready to do this kind of fast turnaround, really relevant analyses?
That's a great question. And I'll just kind of go back to my own experience and why I felt maybe prepared, slightly prepared. You're never prepared for these kinds of things, right?
True,
but
true.
Maybe why I felt slightly more prepared. So my training was in an econ program, but my graduate assistantship was in something called the Center for Business and Economic Research. Mm. And that was a place where we did do some of these quick policy turnaround things. I worked with faculty members who were working with the IMF or the World Bank, or faculty members who were working for the Tennessee Department of Human Services, right? And so they need to make real-time policy decisions. And I think in those situations, it's a compromise, right, between... Mm-hmm. I also worked at the U.S. Government Accountability Office, where we were very slow and methodical and careful about things, right?
Right?
And so it's this mix of trying to be very careful, but then also you have to give them an answer now, because mm-hmm. they have to make a decision. If you give them an answer 5 days from now, it isn't
good. It doesn't matter.
They've already made the decision. And so I think that's where this putting lots of pieces of data together comes into
that. That makes sense, yeah. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today.
It's been great. Thanks for letting me talk about it.
It's been nice to hear your experiences.
This month in the journal Medical Care, we have a packed issue. There are great articles about patient-centered care, disparities in outcomes, practice location choices, and care coordination. There are also some nice brief reports about caregiver burden and machine learning if you have a little bit less time. We also have some excellent commentaries this month. One of our co-editors, Lisa Lines, and her colleagues turned their blog post about imputing race and ethnicity into a commentary. It was excellent to read this slightly longer piece about data collection practices and analyses that may improve or worsen health equity depending on how they're used. Another commentary delves into the whole health transformation at the Veterans Health Administration, and it really echoes the focus on person-centered care that runs throughout blogs and articles this month. The transition at the VHA has been going on for about a decade, and the commentary provides some well-thought-out insights and lessons learned. Whether you're interested in the VHA specifically or more generally in the transformation of large systems, this would be a great piece to read. Another original article is about the patient-provider communication quality and has an accompanying editorial. The research article details findings from a 2002 to 2016 repeated cross-section run through the Medical Expenditure Panel Survey. The authors found that the quality of patient-provider communication increased monotonically for all outcomes. Throughout the study period, individuals identifying as Asian reported the lowest quality communication, with individuals identifying as Black reporting the highest quality. While the differences in reports between racial groups did narrow over time, didn't narrow significantly. The linked commentary stresses the importance of improving communication from an equity perspective, and suggested that future research be done to better understand the factors contributing to low-quality patient-provider communication for Asian Americans, emphasizing the potential differences among subgroups, something that is a persistent problem in research. It was wonderful to share some time with you this month, and I hope you check out the blogs and articles. Happy reading!